protests against a judge investigating last year's Beirut ports blast turned deadly. But Dublin says the EU will reject London's demand for an alternative arbitrator for resolving post-Brexit disputes, including the Northern Ireland Protocol. And New Zealand reports its biggest surge in COVID-19 infections in 6 weeks in its largest city, Auckland. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafik. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with the Lebanese capital city, where a protest against a judge investigating last year's Beirut port blast turned deadly. At least 6 people have been confirmed dead and 60 wounded in heavy gunfire and blasts in the capital city. Army troops have moved to clear the protest site. Demonstrators are outraged at what they see as Washington's interference in the investigation. They say the judge overseeing the case is being swayed by the U.S. Meantime, Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has blamed gunmen from a Christian party, Lebanese forces, for being behind the attacks on protesters in Beirut. Hezbollah said that the snipers fired shots from the top of buildings to kill people. It said the supporters of Hezbollah and the ML movement were attacked. The Lebanese Forces Party has not claimed responsibility, but it had mobilized supporters on Wednesday evening after Hezbollah and the ML movement called for the protests against the judge probing the Beirut port explosion. Hezbollah and ML in a joint statement urged the army to intervene quickly to detain the perpetrators. They said that the attack was aimed at creating strife. Separately, the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council decried the attack as an unspeakable crime. Author and researcher Ali Hamia says that the current instability in Lebanon only works to the advantage of the United States and Israel.
We have our enemy in, you know, at our southern front, and this enemy is supported by United States and some of the inside traitor, as we say. We are resistant in all our means just to keep Lebanon stable and, you know, to defend all our means, by all our means, defending the Lebanese and the territories and the sea borders. But the American conspiracy is not letting us, you know, to do our job. Every time we try to stable our country, we have something coming up by the American. The American and the Israelis are the only side that are benefiting from Lebanon going into sectarian strife or into chaos or violence, whatever, just to not let this government work.
Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Salah, says an official from the Lebanese Forces Party had reportedly visited the area the night before in preparation for ambushing demonstrators.
Well, we were able to come closer to the area where the main fire was coming out from. Let me give you a closer picture.
Sure.
Now, you're probably seeing some of the buildings that are in this area. One of them is where it is supposedly we saw the snipers entrenched, and we have reports that one of the officials of the Lebanese forces came to this area just the night before, reportedly to prepare for the ambush, this ambush that did take place today against the peaceful protesters. And we also were able to see the snipers on top of the rooftop, the buildings. After that stopped, after the sniper fire stopped and the protesters dispersed, then the fire was also within the buildings against the Lebanese army, against the civilians, passersby in this area, mostly coming from one side. The fire was coming from one side. The Lebanese army was trying to contain it, and that was when they were fired at. They tried, of course, to stop those snipers. They said that they will shoot at any armed individual that they see in the buildings and in those areas. They were able to successfully successfully stop this fire, of course. And we have, as we know from security sources, at least 10 names that were identified and known to be members of the Lebanese Forces Party. Hezbollah has called for an investigation into this area. We know that they are
Palestine's Al-Quds Brigades, that's the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, says it's on alert and fully ready to defend Palestinians locked up in Israeli jails. The brigades has even declared a state of mobilization. It says it won't shy away from going to war with the Israeli regime to defend the prisoners. Hamas official Zahar Jabarin also says that prisoners from all factions of resistance groups are ready to join any coordinated measure. Israel has been treating inmates harshly since last month when six Palestinians escaped a top security jail. They were later recaptured. 400 prisoners are on hunger strike in protest at the tough conditions.
In solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails, Palestinians held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in the Gaza city, demanding an end to the recent Israeli strict treatment against the inmates. Following the recent jailbreak of six inmates from the high-security Jabu prison, Israeli regime keeps practicing inhumane policies and increasing abuse against Palestinian detainees.
We are here to send this message to our prisoners that we won't leave them alone in this battle against the Israeli regime. We won't remain silent over the violations of the rights of our inmates in Israeli jails. The international community should make an urgent action to provide protection for our prisoners.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, dozens of Palestinian detainees from Islamic Jihad have begun their open-ended hunger strike on Wednesday, protesting the Israeli violations and torture inside jails.
Following the heroic escape operation by six inmates, the Israeli regime began to intensify its inhumane torturing policies against our brothers, especially the Islamic Jihad members. Our prisoners have started their hunger strike protesting the inhumane policies of the Israeli regime.
In his speech, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, Ziyad al-Nakhala, announced the movement's readiness to respond firmly against the Israeli violations of prisoners' rights, even if this leads to a new round of violence.
We are here today to support our prisoners who have begun their hunger strike. We call on the international community to stop these violations. We warn the Israeli regime that it will face a firm response if these punitive measures are not stopped. Israel is responsible for the lives of our detainees.
About 400 prisoners who belong to the Islamic Jihad movement have begun their hunger strike with the support of other factions. The strike is in protest of Tel Aviv's inhumane measures against Palestinian prisoners, intensified following the escape of six inmates from a high-security Israeli prison last month, Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kenny says that his country is always ready to engage in talks that could result in a practical agreement. Meeting with a visiting European Union coordinator on Iran, Bagheri Kenny stressed the importance of tangible results in any talks with the Islamic Republic. He, however, questioned Washington's willingness to stay true to his commitments with regard to the Iran nuclear deal. He urged Brussels to act responsibly, saying that the EU had failed to honor its obligations under the nuclear deal. EU envoy Enrique Mora reiterated the bloc's readiness to cooperate with Tehran and the other signatories to the deal. The two diplomats also agreed to continue consultations on removing anti-Iran sanctions in the Belgian capital within the next few days. Now, Dublin saying that the European Union will reject London's demand to consider an alternative arbitrator to resolve post-Brexit disputes, including the Northern Ireland Protocol. Ireland's European Affairs Minister Thomas Byrne says that a European Court of Justice arbitrates on the bloc's single market in which Ireland is allowed to remain. However, London says that the court should not have a role in the issue. The EU put forward new proposals on Wednesday in an attempt to settle the row over the Northern Ireland Protocol. The proposals include reduced customs checks and paperwork on British products to smooth trade between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK. The protocol is a key part of the Brexit deal. London has urged the bloc to rewrite the deal, a request flatly rejected by Brussels.
Relations between the EU and Britain remain at an all-time low. The so-called Northern Ireland Protocol was agreed almost 2 years ago and is a key part of the Brexit deal. Despite having negotiated it, Boris Johnson now says the protocol is not working. The EU has just put forward proposals to alter it.
We have completely turned our rules upside down and inside out to find a solid solution to an outstanding challenge.
Under the changes, checks and controls on goods moving from Britain to Northern Ireland will be reduced by more than half. EU laws will be amended to allow medicines licensed in Britain move freely to Northern Ireland. The EU sees the protocol as essential because it prevents border controls between Ireland, which is a member of the bloc, and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK.
The Good Friday Agreement has to be preserved and no return to a hard border. The British have to work that out with ourselves here in Europe and with Ireland, but that has to be a bottom line for us.
Since Brexit, anti-EU political parties have been established in almost every one of the bloc's 27 member states.
We're being dragged into an EU army. They're imposing laws and regulations upon us which hurt the Irish economy. And now the corporate tax regime, they're after us for that. So Ireland, as things move forward, the benefits are reducing.
Analysts say the fallout from Brexit could also spell big trouble for the United Kingdom. There's growing support in Northern Ireland for a referendum on a United Ireland. Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom. EU officials are currently in London to try and avert an all-out trade war between the bloc and Britain. EU Commissioner Sefcovic will travel there on Friday to meet his opposite number, British Brexit Minister David Frost. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
New Zealand has reported its biggest rise in COVID-19 infections in 6 weeks, with all cases detected in the city of Auckland.
My message today is clear. We need people in Auckland to stick to the alert level 3 rules. As the Director of Public Health has just said, this outbreak is not in a small number of clusters in a small geographical area. It is affecting people in all parts of Auckland, which makes it everyone's job in Auckland to help prevent its spread.
The Deputy Premier also said that the surge was not unexpected and blamed it on illegal home gatherings. 1.7 million people in Auckland are under strict stay-at-home orders until Monday. 71 new local cases were reported there, up from 55 a day earlier. All infections are said to be from the Delta variant. The spike has raised the prospect for an extension of lockdown to the city beyond next week. According to New Zealand's Health Ministry, total number of cases now stands at over 4,800. Britain has reported 42,000 new coronavirus cases and 157 related deaths in the past day. And the new figures push the overall death toll to more than 138,000 and confirmed cases to over 8.2 million. Britain remains the worst country in Europe in terms of infections. The death toll is the second highest on the continent after Russia. More than 45 million Britons have been fully vaccinated. That's more than 79% of its total population, but a country has witnessed a relative surge in infections over the past couple of days, which officials blame on the Delta variant. Now, gripped by a new aggressive wave of the COVID-19, Russia is breaking its own record in deaths and infections set in the past 2 days. The fatalities rose by only 2 to hit 986 in the past day, and that was enough to set a grim new record. Russia's total death toll is now past 220,000. That's the highest in Europe. The country also registered a single-day record for cases on Thursday, over 31,000 new infections. Total caseload in Russia is getting closer to the grim milestone of 8 million. Officials blame the spike on the sluggish vaccination rollout. The world is experiencing an energy crisis that's affecting countries from the west all the way to the east, from the UK to China, and especially in Europe, there is a shortage of energy. Storage capacities are running at minimum capacity. But why have energy resources run to such lows? The coronavirus pandemic is one of the factors affecting production and the supply chain.
The world is in the midst of a global energy crisis. Prices in Europe, North America, and Asia have spiraled to multi-year highs in recent weeks. Energy demand is rallying as economies ramp up after the end of pandemic lockdowns, and there are dips in supplies from renewable resources. Energy demand is back today as the world economy reopens, but supply simply hasn't kept up. That is why U.S. oil prices have skyrocketed $120 since crashing to negative $40 a barrel back in April 2020. U.S. oil prices finished above $80 a barrel on Monday for the first time in nearly 7 years. High gas prices will only exacerbate elevated inflation and squeeze the budgets of ordinary families.
Well, we got a little bit of a return of demand as the growth comes off the floor during the COVID era here, and we got economies that are trying to recover. So there's a little bit of that going on. But because it's going on, I believe that global speculators are really responsible for the most of the recent surge in global commodities in general, including oil, natural gas, and so forth.
In Britain, a shortage of the truck drivers who move fuel has led to panic buying amid fears of a shortage. After Brexit, many European truck drivers went back to their home countries and never returned. Some in Europe accuse Russia of deliberately restricting gas flows to the continent. But Russian President Vladimir Putin has brushed off allegations that Moscow is using energy as a weapon, saying that Europe's gas shortage is largely caused by systematic flaws in the continent's energy market. European electricity and gas prices have skyrocketed this year as tight gas supplies have collided with strong demand in economies recovering from COVID-19 pandemic. The International Monetary Fund says persistent supply chain disruptions and inflation pressures are constraining the global economic recovery from the pandemic.
I don't think, however, that this is going to continue for very much longer. The global economy is really weaker than some say. And I think when the GDP figures come out soon for the U.S. for the third quarter, fourth quarter, it'll be clear that we don't have a runaway recovery. We have a rebound going on, but we don't have a really robust, sustained economic recovery.
Now, during these times when energy resources are running at historic lows, the world can use a boost to its supplies. There are two countries that are left out of that equation, Iran and Venezuela. The Venezuelan-Iranian gas sectors can play a big role in gas exports to Europe and the wider world. Yet the U.S. sanctions are preventing these countries from selling their precious commodity. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight.
Several scientists advising the British government have said that the failure to prevent the second wave of coronavirus pandemic was inexcusable given how much was then known about the virus and the imminent availability of COVID vaccines. We now present you an article written jointly by Ian Sample, Robert Booth, Peter Walker, and Stephen Morris. The piece is titled UK Scientists React to COVID Inquiry. The real problem is the repetition of mistakes. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more. After a damning report by MPs on the handling of the coronavirus pandemic, senior scientists have told The Guardian newspaper the failure to prevent tens of thousands of deaths during Britain's brutal second wave of COVID infections was a more serious error than the timing of the first lockdown. The Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, known as SAGE, warned ministers in September of 2020 that the country faced a very large epidemic with catastrophic consequences, unless they took immediate action and imposed a circuit breaker to bring soaring cases under control. But the advice went unheeded and was only made public 3 weeks later, after Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced the three-tier system as an alternative. It was abandoned for a national lockdown in November of 2020. Several scientists advising the British government said that the failure to prevent the second wave of coronavirus pandemic was inexcusable, given how much was then known about the virus and the imminent availability of COVID vaccines. Ministers were warned in October of 2020 that the tier system was inadequate and that the death toll from the second wave would reach tens of thousands of people. Between SAGE's call for a September 2020 circuit breaker and March of 2021, more than 80,000 people died from COVID, with the winter outbreak largely fueled by the Alpha variant of the coronavirus first discovered in Kent. A first official report on the early handling of the pandemic, published on Tuesday, 12th of October, by cross-party MPs, described it as one of the worst public health failures in Britain's history. It concluded, groupthink by ministers and scientists, including a deliberately slow approach to imposing the first lockdown, led the United Kingdom to fare significantly worse than other countries. However, Professor Stephen Reicher, a member of the behavioral science subgroup that feeds into SAGE, said the government was bound to make mistakes early on in the crisis, but criticized ministers for making the same errors many times over. He said, "To me, the real problem is the repetition of these mistakes. We made mistakes at the beginning, but then made the same mistakes again and again." Professor Stephen Reicher noted, "Most of the time there was a consensus among the scientists, as there was about last autumn, and the need for a circuit breaker." He added, "The real issue was not any split between scientists about what government should do, but about what scientists advised and what government did." Professor Reicher took issue with MP's report for blaming failures, at least partially, on groupthink, arguing that the phrase "let people off the hook." He said the main problem was a paternalistic ideology that sees the public as a problem, that sees the private sector as the best way to run the test and trace system, and fails to see the value of public health at a local level. He said the same ideology gave rise to the assumption, rejected by behavioral scientists, that locking down early would fail because people would become fatigued. He said, This paternalistic approach, where people are seen as a problem, is one of the biggest mistakes of the pandemic. Professor Peter Openshaw, a member of the government's New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group, or NERVTAG, said that early on in Britain's epidemic, few scientists were confident that vaccines would be developed, trialled and approved by the end of 2020. As such, many early discussions centred on when, rather than whether, people would get infected. Despite the uncertainties, scientists on New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats and Advisory Group, known as NERVTAG, concluded that Britain needed to go into lockdown. But Professor Peter Openshaw said he spent weeks wondering why policymakers had not decided to take that step. He said, "I remember feeling deeply uncomfortable about this, thinking they must have evidence that we don't have, that has made them decide not to institute the lockdown immediately." Speaking in a personal capacity, Professor Mark Woolhouse, a member of the modelling subgroup that feeds into SAGE, said an earlier lockdown in spring of 2020 would probably have saved more lives, but the number may have been far fewer than suggested at the time and needed to be considered alongside the impact of lockdown, including deaths from disrupted health services. He said actions taken and actions not taken in January and February in the United Kingdom, internationally, and especially by the World Health Organization, are likely to have been at least as important as the decisions in March. He added, "Hopefully, the full inquiries to come will look into that period in more detail." Meanwhile, bereaved families have called for the COVID public inquiry to be accelerated and for ministers to apologise after a damning report by MPs on the handling of the pandemic. Dr. Cathy Gardner, whose father died from the coronavirus after his care home was infected by the discharge of untested patients in March of 2020, said the government must appoint a chair for the planned inquiry now rather than by Christmas, as Prime Minister Boris Johnson has promised. The Royal College of Nursing also called for a faster start to the inquiry, and Labour Party leader Keir Starmer and the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice group said ministers must say sorry for the handling of the crisis. The Labour leader said the Prime Minister should take responsibility because the responsibility is his and he should apologise. Hours after the first official report on the early handling of the pandemic was published, the Cabinet Office Minister Steve Barclay refused to apologise, telling the BBC, "The British government took decisions at the time based on the scientific advice that it received, but those scientists themselves were operating in a very new environment." In Wales, the health minister of the devolved government, Eluned Morgan, told a press conference, "I'm prepared to apologise to all those who have suffered during the pandemic. This was a new disease. None of us knew how it would impact. None of us knew how it was going to spread." A full statutory public inquiry into Britain's pandemic preparedness and response is due to start in spring of 2022 and will have powers to compel the disclosure of evidence in a way that MPs could not. Labour MP Sarah Owen, a member of the Commons Health and Social Care Committee, which jointly drew up the report, told The Guardian, "It's necessarily limited scope and conclusions. Whilst valuable, showed the need for a full public inquiry as soon as possible to determine the chain of accountability." Labour MP Sarah Owen added, "It's clear from our report that mistakes were made, but people have a right to know who was responsible for those mistakes and how we prevent them in the future." The Relatives and Residents Association, which represents care home residents and their families, said the report proved they were abandoned in the early stages of the pandemic and continue to be left behind today. Helen Wildbore, the director of Relatives and Residents Association, said, "We must urgently learn lessons to ensure older people's rights are protected now. Waiting until the spring for a public inquiry to start will be too late for too many." Lobby Akinola, a spokesperson for the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice, said, "Had the government taken different decisions, thousands of those lost would still be alive today. The very least that should happen is the government should apologize for this. But what families need even more is a rigorous inquiry with bereaved families involved at every single step of the process." Dr. Kathy Gardner said she feared ministers were hiding information about their pandemic response after the MP's report revealed officials had failed to disclose evidence about how they calculated South Korea's more cautious containment strategy, which was not subsequently followed. According to official figures, South Korea has had 2,594 COVID deaths compared with Britain's 137,763. The MP's report also failed to mention the existence of the 2016 cross-government Exercise Alice war game for a large outbreak of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, coronavirus. It warned of the need for stockpiles of personal protective equipment, border checks, and a ready-made contact tracing system. The health secretary at the time was Jeremy Hunt, who was the joint chair of the MP's coronavirus inquiry. The exercise was attended by Dame Sally Davis, then England's chief medical officer, and involved senior officials from the Department of Health and Social Care, NHS England, Public Health England, and the Cabinet Office. Asked about his knowledge of the exercise on Tuesday, 12th of October, Jeremy Hunt said, "It was not briefed to ministers." Appearing on ITV's Good Morning Britain programme, he said, "There was a groupthink that the way you tackle a pandemic should be similar to a flu pandemic. I was part of that groupthink too when I was health secretary."
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now let's listen to the speech of Sheikh Jafar Jafar.
Out of the many, many things that the 11th Imam did, out of the turath and the legacies that the Imam alayhi salam left, and we'll just describe a few, and there are many more that are also mentioned in the books of tariq. But the first thing that we have to realize was the age in which the Imam lived. Politically, the Abbasids were in dysfunction. We know that there were so many different Abbasid caliphs who were rising and falling, rising and falling. But at the same time, they had one eye on the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam, because the legacy and the traditions were very clear that there will be 12, and the 12th one would be the Mahdi, and who would come and he would avenge. And so they knew that according to clear calculations that Imam al-Askari alayhi salam was the 11th. And so the Imam was constantly harassed. We said within the six years of Imamah, half of that was spent in prison. Why? Because they wanted to make sure that they had him under constant watch. And they were waiting to pounce on him and his birth and the newborn that would come, because they knew that that would be the 12th Imam. And so one of the things that the Imam alayhi salam did was that he hid the pregnancy of his wife and did not inform anyone. Even his aunt, Sayyidah Hakima, was not aware of the pregnancy or the imminent birth of our 12th Imam until the morning or the night and the morning of his delivery. This is how secret it was kept from his family, from his companions. But then after the birth of the Imam alayhi salam, our 11th Imam made sure that he revealed the birth of his son to his closest companions. And not only that, that when the time was right, the Imam alayhi salam also showed the people, his companions, the 12th Imam. There's one particular tradition from Muhammad bin Ayyub bin Nuh or Muhammad bin Uthman al-Amri. They say, قالوا عرض, they say, عرض علينا أبو محمد حسن بن علي عليه السلام ابنه that ونحن في منزله وكنا أربعين رجلا. He says there was about 40 of us who were in the house of the 11th Imam when all of a sudden the Imam عليه السلام showed us his son. فقال هذا إمامكم من بعدي. He said to them that this is your Imam after me. He must have been no more than 5 years old for sure, right? Very young. But he said that this will be your Imam after me, wa khalifati alaykum. And he will be your representative, my representative upon you. Ati'u wa la tatafarraku. Obey him and do not disperse or fight. Min ba'di. And do not separate after me. Fatahliku. Otherwise you will be perished. Fi adyanikum, ama innakum la tarawnahu ba'da yawmikum hadha, and know that you will not see him again after this day. Subhanallah. Yeah? That he showed the Imam to them and then he made it clear that they will not see him. He says, ثُمَّ خَرَجْنَا فَخَرَجْنَا مِنْ إِنْدِهِ فَمَا مَضَتْ إِلَّا أَيَّامٌ قَلَائِلْ حَتَّى مَضَى أَبُو مُحَمَّدَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ. He says that we left having seen the Imam, and a few days later the 11th Imam was shaheed and he left this world. This step seems like you can look at it trivially and be like, okay, what's the big deal? He showed the people the Imam. But this is important, right? Because if he had not shown these 40 people the Imam, the Abbasid conspiracy theorists or the people who cause conspiracies could have easily propagated traditions to say that the 11th Imam never had a son. He just talked about a son. He never had a son. And imagine people's faith thinking that the 12th hasn't been born yet, right? And so this was essential and it's magical. I'm honestly, like, when you think about it, obviously nothing they do is arbitrary, right? But this one step eliminates doubt altogether about the existence of the 12th Imam, and it is fundamental to our faith. There is a tradition from our sixth Imam, As-Sadiq alayhi afdalu salatu wassalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad, where he says, Inna li sahibi hadha al-amr ghaybatan. He says, certainly the rightful owner of this rule, yani the 12th Imam, will have a ghaybah, will have an occultation. Al-mutamassiku fiha bidinihi kal-khariti lishawkil qatadi biyadi. He says that one who wants to adhere to his religion during it will be like the one who clutches onto a thorn bush with his hand. The Imam, subhanAllah. Can you imagine holding onto a thorn bush with its thorns and poking you, and you still have to hold on to it because that's how difficult the period of ghaibah is. And so what the Imam alayhi salam did set this foundation. But I want to come to us today and do a little bit of reflection, right? We have to ask ourselves a serious question, okay? Is ghaibah difficult for us today, right? I know it's a loaded question because right away, our faith will kick in and answer. So if we were to ask, like, do we need the Imam in our lives, right? And obviously the faith will answer, be like, of course we need the Imam in our lives. I would ask then, like, I don't ask you this question without having soul-searched myself and asked myself this question. I pray for the Imam every single day and night. But we need to create this longing for our Imam. How do we do that? We've given many practical solutions in the past, right? Think about him often. Set alarms on your phone. Think about you must have heard me say this a gazillion times. But set alarms on your phone. Wear your watch in a different hand. Put your wallet on a different side. Put your hijab pin on a different side. Why? Because it will remind you more frequently of the Imam. But we have to create this longing for the Imam. And so we have to create this longing for the Imam. That's number one. We do need to feel the pain of others as our pain. So when I see injustice happening, it should crack me. It should break me, right? Whether it is through believers or non-believers, I should be affected by it. And we are generally affected by it. And that's where we have to hold on to this rope of the legacy that our 11th Imam alayhi salam left us, right? The firm belief in his return. Everything I'm doing in my life is either extending his return or is hastening his return. Everything, right? And so where do I want to be? Do I want to be the cause of his delay or do I want to be the cause of his arrival? I need to maintain constant connection with the righteous ulama. I need to make sure that I am communicating with the Imam, right? Because that's what people did with the 11th Imam. So I'm writing letters to the Imam, or I'm speaking from my heart to the Imam, or I'm speaking with my tongue to the Imam. But this needs to be regular. And I need to practice this active intizar, right? Intizarul faraj, this active awaiting of the Imam, alayhi salam. But these are some of the things that, you know, keep me up at night. And when I think and I reflect. And I hope, inshallah, that this legacy that the 11th Imam, alayhi salam, has left us will be one that will not be misused by us, but rather we will utilize it to gain the strength of being better servants to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and be ready companions for our 12th Imam.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The day will indeed dawn when not just the Golan Heights,
but all of Palestine will be liberated by the sons of the soil, no matter what crimes the Zionists continue to commit through air raids on Syria or the violation of the sanctity of Islam's third holiest site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Beit al-Muqaddas, a city which the Western media wrongly calls Jerusalem. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, Israeli Regime Scared to Death of Imminent Liberation of Golan. Stay tuned for more. The elected government in Damascus is steadily liberating the areas occupied by a variety of terrorists, ranging from the macabrely murderous Takfiris in Idlib in the north to the equally bloodthirsty Americans and their clients in the oil-rich Deir ez-Zor region in the east, or for that matter, the Turkish army, which without any violation has crossed the common border into Syria. As the liberating process continues slowly but surely, President Bashar al-Assad hasn't lost sight of the strategic American-occupied Atanf Triangle, where the borders of three countries, including Syria, Jordan, and Iraq, meet and through which the crucial M2 Damascus-Baghdad highway passes. At the same time, Syria is determined to regain control one day of the southern part of the Golan Heights from the racist Zionist entity, which occupied it in 1967 and later, in violation of the UN Charter, has illegally annexed it. This has unnerved the Israeli regime, as is evident by the recent remarks of the new terrorist at the helm of affairs in Tel Aviv, Naftali Bennett, who is trying to double the illegally settled small Jewish population of the Golan, whose majority is still made up of Druze Arabs, all still holding Syrian citizenship. He has threatened to change the face of the Golan Heights by adding that he will quadruple the Jewish population there by settling Zionists coming to Palestine from other parts of the world. Bennett, as usual, blamed the Islamic Republic of Iran for helping the Syrian government wipe out the Takfiri terrorists and liberate over 70% of the occupied parts of the country. He fears that the day is not far when Islamic Iran, as the beating heart of the axis of resistance, will provide the necessary assistance to Syria to liberate the Golan Heights, whose annexure no world country except for the criminal regime of the previous U.S. President Donald Trump has recognized. The fake regime of Israel is living on borrowed time. The day will indeed dawn when not just the Golan Heights, but all of Palestine will be liberated by the sons of the soil, no matter what crimes the Zionists continue to commit through air raids in Syria or the violation of the sanctity of Islam's third holiest site, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Beit al-Muqaddas, a city which the Western media wrongly calls Jerusalem. Of course, whether or not the Israelis double or quadruple the number of the illegally settled Jews in the Golan or increase their occupation forces and weapons, they will not be able to change the identity and destiny of these strategic Syrian heights. It is only a matter of time and a day the government, the army, and the people of Syria decide to push into the southern occupied parts of Golan. no Zionist army or mercenary forces from the US and Europe will be able to stop them. It is earnestly hoped that before it is too late, the United Nations will persuade the Israeli regime to return the occupied parts of the Golan Heights to Syria. If not, there is no other option to liberate it except through armed confrontation that will not stop at the foothills but will spread all the way to Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Beit al-Muqaddas. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. A few words of advice to eulogists. The 3rd of February, 2021. Adopting a serious approach in creating a culture and in promoting the ideological and cultural principles of Islam. I have a few words of advice to you, dear eulogists. These are my last statements today. The first words of advice is that you should take this great and heavy responsibility seriously. You should take seriously the responsibility to promote and to expand the ideological and cultural principles of Islam. This is very important, and it is the basis of your work. You should set this as the pivot of your work. So, the first piece of advice is to promote important ideas, words of advice and insightful lessons with artistic tools, skills and innovations which are available to all of you.
Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha.
preserving the form and spirit of eulogy. The second word of advice is that you should preserve the form of eulogy. Eulogies and the management of the group and the occasion should not be mistaken with similar tasks and jobs which are done here and there. The form of eulogy should be preserved. You can benefit from all artistic tools that I referred to, your good voice, good singing, and good songs, but you should never try to use forms outside of eulogies. You should avoid these forms, and you should not allow the gatherings of eulogies to turn into other occasions and environments. Those gatherings, or hay'ats, should remain as hay'ats. This is the second point, and I hope that you will carefully pay attention to this issue, inshallah, God willing. The next word of advice is precision. You should try to convey the message in a precise manner. What should be said about the Holy Prophet's life, historic lessons, ideological and religious points, and elegy should be said in a precise, reasonable, and solid manner. Of course, this applies more to those poets who have composed poems of the purpose of eulogy. They should have adequate religious and historical knowledge, and they should have a correct understanding of the Holy Prophet's life and religious teachings.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.